you know, we had a man lynched on television, and we still just talking about it. People had to riot and loot places for those people to be charged. Right. We got a long way to go. People are willing to do whatever to make that happen, and, you know, black people just fed up. Simple as that.
Macy Brown is an 18-year-old who's getting ready for her freshman year at North Carolina A&T. And last Saturday, along with three of her peers, she organized a Black Lives Matter protest in Jackson, Mississippi.
We had 5 days to get it together. We got 5,000 people out there. All we did was create it. We put it out on social media. The people of Mississippi did the work. I think that, you know, people here were eager for change, but they didn't know where to look to get that change. You know, it's not black people's problem to fix the race issue in America. We can't fix what we didn't break. We can't fix that. We didn't create the system that oppressed us, so how in the hell are we going to be the one to somehow come up with the solution? It is necessary for whatever idea of freedom that we're fighting for, because honestly, we don't know what freedom looks like. Americans do not know what freedom looks like. When have we ever been at a point where people were free, where nobody was oppressed? So the idea of freedom that we're fighting for is something that we don't even know what that looks like. We got to figure that part out.
For the New York Times, this is Together Apart. I'm Priya Parker. As we witness the murder of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and countless others, and subsequently watched as millions of people around the world poured into the streets to be physically together, this conversation with Macy stopped me in my tracks. In particular, what she says about freedom. We're fighting for something that we don't even know what that looks like. Macy's words reminded me of a project that a friend, artist, and fellow facilitator began well before COVID hit.
So, welcome everybody to the first installation of the Black Thought Project. Woo! So, I'm Alicia Walters. I'm the creator of this project, and the idea behind this is to transform Oakland into a sanctuary for Black thought, right?
So I called Alicia. I told her about Macy's question, and she said she was getting chills because she had been thinking about this very question on a hike last Saturday. She even sent me a voice memo she'd recorded as she was hiking.
Questions for Black Thought Wall. What do you want for your precious black life? What makes you feel safe? If all black people were truly free, what would the world look and feel like?
A few days later, we got back on the phone.
Yeah, so I live in Oakland, California. Every Saturday, I have the amazing pleasure of taking about 3 hours to just hike by myself amongst the redwoods and the wildflowers and wildlife here in Northern California. And it's a place of refuge. It's a place where, you know, I'm mostly talking to myself. There's some crying, there's some processing of things, but it's sort of my time, right? This past Saturday, I started with a lot of grief, and I was really just calling the names of my friends who've lost parents during this time. And pretty soon, you know, within 10, 15 minutes, I was feeling the grief and just really recalling, calling the names of my friends who've lost parents just during COVID, from COVID or from pre-existing illnesses that had them vulnerable.
And what are some of those names?
Marcia, Destiny, Shayna, Consuelo, Sharla, and Stephanie. And just opening to people who are now ancestors. And in this moment, I feel like I want I need their wisdom so much. And the week before, as I was listening to music and kind of busting open, one of the things that I remember feeling is I wanted so badly to hear from the ancestors. I wanted them in some way, somehow, to let us know we were going to be okay, let us know what to do, you know, where to go, help guide and support and lead and encourage us, you know, from all sides.
Tell me a little bit about your ancestors. Who do you come from?
I know I had a grandfather who came over in a cargo ship and many other, you know, ancestors who came over in slave ships. So arriving here in different ways, right? I was born to a Black Puerto Rican father and a white Scotch-Irish mama from Minneapolis, actually, whose high school was not far from where George Floyd was murdered. And they met and went to school and, you know, raised me at least partially in Spokane, Washington. When I say partially, it's because my father left when I was 6 months old. I'm the youngest of three, so I have two older brothers. And my sort of social justice awareness began actually through my mother, who always worked in various nonprofits and in domestic violence shelters, in a youth home for a long time, and for 17 years, then becoming associate director at what used to be thought of as a home for troubled youth, right? Mm. And yet my Blackness and obviously my skin color, my lineage as being, you know, of the African diaspora comes from my father, but my racial identity doesn't come from my father. Mm-hmm. What I have gotten from him and that sort of what he passed on to me was every time we would visit my dad, and he lived 300 miles west of us in Seattle. But when we would go and visit my dad, we would just play the full range of Black music and dance for hours in the living room. We listened to gospel, R&B, hip hop, whatever, like Michael Jackson in particular. But then it'd be like Cuban and Puerto Rican salsa. And my dad was like a disco and salsa king and in music videos. And like, you know, so we danced and it was like this fluid, like range of Black music that felt so resonant. It felt so much like me. And whether it's because I could tell I was so different, which was very apparent from the beginning, my skin color, the texture of my hair, the makeup of my family. But I always knew I was Black. And even when there were people throughout my childhood, always white people, who would say, oh, but you're not really Black. Mm. I could see right through that, right? It usually came on the heels of some what they would consider a radical statement on race or whatever I believed or whatever critique or sort of understanding or belief I had about racism. They would say, yeah, well, you're not really Black. And in that way, I understood that they were trying to discount what I was saying. They, in their twisted way, were thinking they were giving me a compliment by diminishing Blackness. Hmm. And in both instances, it was very apparent to me, this doesn't feel good. It's not right. And I am Black. And I know that. And I know that what you're doing is about your whiteness, not about my Blackness. And I think, you know, having a white parent and, you know, a mixed background sort of provides this natural or obvious entree to having a struggle with belonging. And I think there's a narrative in our culture around that where people who think of themselves as biracial might say, I'm not either, right? I'm not white, I'm not Black, I'm something else. And not to discount that, but that's not how I felt. But the thing I did struggle with was belonging. And I actually think that that's part of the Black experience, is the struggle with belonging, because we're in a place where we were never meant to belong. And we're constantly being shown that we don't belong. But I remember, you know, growing up, there was something like those comments that I would get that fueled me to where by the time I was in high school, I actually started a club that later became a leadership course called HOPE, Helping Overcome Prejudice Everywhere. And I remember in high school teaching a class to my peers, all white, maybe one or two people of color, bless their hearts, sprinkled in the crowd. I taught Peggy McIntosh's Unpacking the Invisible White Knapsack.
I love that piece.
And I spent a lot of time in those years educating white people. And frankly, that's not work I do anymore.
Mm-hmm. I know.
What I've come to understand and know for sure is that the focus on white supremacy, even of saying we need to dismantle this, we need to dismantle white supremacy, still brings our attention to whiteness. And I believe that the only way to truly undo and live in a new society with new relationships to each other, with new power dynamics, is to center Blackness. And by that, I mean, it's not just replacing one racial hierarchy where whiteness is at the top with another racial hierarchy where another race is at the top or Blackness is at the top. It's not even hierarchical in that way. It's seeing the world through the lens of the Black experience. And what does this teach us about our own humanity? And the possibility, I think, for living in our full humanity comes through centering Blackness. So when you take and when you look at and understand a people who the entire world, every single society has decided that Blackness is at the bottom, degraded, valued least, right? It is global. And when instead you take that experience and you understand that in order to consider your fellow human beings, and in fact, where we all come from as humans is Africa. And in order to believe that we are not human, you have to sever a part of your own humanity in order to not recognize and embrace an entire category of human beings. And so centering Blackness actually returns us to our humanity. The only way to do away with and to create a new sort of society was to see everything through Blackness.
So give me an example.
So for instance, imagine what safety, like safety so far has been defined when you understand that Blackness is considered a threat. And so safety is defined as keeping us safe from Blackness, right? That's what policing is actually for, is keeping, controlling the threat of Blackness. And you understand in this society that it's not actually behavior that's criminalized, it's people. And so whatever their behavior is, whether it's barbecuing, walking in a particular neighborhood, driving a car, existing on the sidewalk, those are all threats, right? And so instead, like the only way to understand that in a revolutionary sense, like if we're really trying to build toward a new society, we can't do that. We can't account for that without putting Blackness in the middle to say, these are the people who have actually been least safe in society. What does safety mean for them? And therefore, what does safety mean for all of us? Like safety through the lens of Blackness. And if you don't, then you fall back into the norm.
In this example, by centering Blackness, what you're forcing is to make us actually see where, like, what is threat?
Right. We are redefining threat.
Yeah.
Right.
As I listened to her and understood even more how ubiquitous anti-Blackness is, how embedded, even foundational, it is to our society, I started to understand even more deeply that we can't see our way out of this thing with the same goggles that got us here.
And it also doesn't just happen. Like it's not just a word, it's a way of life, right? It's not a theory. It has to change how we live. And by that I mean, and this sort of takes us into the Black Thought Project realm.
You are the first person, in part when you told me about your Black Thought Project last year, that was the first time I began to even understand what that even means or would look like. And your project, and I love your work because, as you said, it takes it out of the philosophical into the everyday like interactions of people. So tell us a little bit about the Black Thought Project and what it is, how you came to it.
So the Black Thought Project transforms public and private spaces into sanctuaries for the expression of Black thought and therefore Black people. So I envision communities where Black people are given safe spaces to reflect, to process our own trauma, to be in community with each other, and to be witnessed in that in a non-exploitative way, right? To be honored in our experiences and our perspectives and recognized as the seed of our nation's healing. I truly believe that the Black experience is the seed of our nation's healing. Our first Black Thought Wall happened almost exactly a year ago on July 12th, 2019 at the Oakland Museum of California. And they have this giant Black chalkboard wall. And it's about 12 feet high by 48 feet long. It's huge. And it's completely chalkboard, you know, all completely just a blank canvas, which just makes me salivate. I brought in a musician and friend of mine that I used to perform with, and his son, actually, he's a Black man from San Francisco with five children who are all homeschooled and musical prodigies. Hmm. And so they came in and played just beautiful instrumental music, improvised, that was very conducive to just being in your feelings. So there's this beautiful music happening. And in terms of the questions that I wanted people to respond to, it was sort of this flow of, one, starting them in a place of love and honor and acknowledgement of themselves. So the first question that's up on the wall is, what do you love most about yourself? And the second question on the wall was, if you had no fear or limitation, what would you be or do? And the final question was, what are your dreams for your community and for Oakland? At the top of the wall, it says, a wall for Black people to share our perspectives. And Black people is underlined like 8 times. It's like, just in case you were wondering, this is for Black people. So we set up the experience in this way. First of all, ritual is very important to me. And so I wanted to see a ritual opening and a ritual closing of this space. Because again, the Black experience is sacred. And if we're going to take these words and these perspectives and this experience as a sacred experience that's sort of a portal and a lived experience of the world we want to see, that's a ritual, right? This is important. This is deep. And so I gave a talk about why we were doing this and what it means to actually create spaces where Black people feel safe to share themselves. And some people got it right away, but some really, we needed to be invited in because we're so used to being excluded. So the other piece was making sure that there were non-Black people who would intervene if non-Black people tried to use the wall in some way, tried to write on the wall. And I noticed early on, like, it was easier for people to actually start talking about the dreams for other people and really standing and reflecting on, what do I love about myself? What do I want for my own life? And I really saw Black people like taking it in and breathing it in and taking their time. And it was this meditative experience. One of the interactions that I remember was a young Black man, probably, you know, in his early 20s, getting up as high as he possibly could to write in huge block letters, "Reclaim Oakland." and a white boy, probably 8 years old, with his mother, who was also white. I was observing, and he asked his mother, "Mom, why is he writing that up there? What does that mean? What does Reclaim Oakland mean?" Hmm. And she said, "Well, let's ask him. Let's see if he'll tell us." And they walked up, and here's this beautiful conversation with a Black man talking about what Oakland means to him, what his community looked like before, and how, you know, the more people move in, the fewer of his people that he sees. And he has family members who've moved away and who can't afford to live here anymore. And the lake looks different. And, you know, the makeup of the city looks different, and he misses, and he wants it back.
More on this in a moment. This is Together Apart. I'm Priya Parker. Alicia is creating a temporary alternative world through this Black Thought Project for people, both Black and non-Black, to practice a different way of being together, consciously, in public, that gives everyone a shared experience of what it's like for all of them to center Blackness, which requires unlearning so much of what we've been taught about race. She's creating rules. This wall is for Black people. But she's also very explicit that non-Black people are welcome. In fact, they are needed. And she helps them understand what role they can play. And it is a different role, an important role, and that is to witness, honor, and protect Black thought. Part of unlearning racism, or rather practicing being anti-racist, is, and this is Alicia's insight, that it's not only an intellectual process, it needs to be practiced, in this case, physically, experimentally. And she was doing all this in person before COVID hit.
COVID hit, and I realized, oh, I can't do this in public anymore, like, or it has to look radically differently. And sort of thinking, do I make this virtual? Does this translate digitally? And it doesn't, because it sort of just becomes a Twitter town hall where then you have white people being like, I'm listening, and it's not the same. So that's when I realized, oh, this is actually a gathering. And just like Bria talks about, we have rules and roles. We have ritual. I sort of knew it before, but it was really reinforced how important it is that this be in person. And so trying to think through, okay, how could this work, right?
And then it struck me. Alicia is now thinking about hosting a gathering that seeks to answer Macy's original question.
So the idea of freedom that we're fighting for is something that we don't even know what that looks like. We got to figure that part out.
So, and I would actually love your thinking on this too. Mm-hmm. I also thought about having kind of a more traditional Black Thought wall that I've had, which is asking a set of questions. And the questions that came up for me were by asking, what do you want for your precious Black life? Mm. What makes you feel safe? And then if all Black people were truly free, what would the world look and feel like? Mm. And I feel like we don't have to know exactly what it looks like, but we have to be able to dream that it's possible, that something on the other side of this is possible.
Yes.
And then I think for other people to recognize, and part of what the Black Thought Project does is recognize that even if something isn't designed for you, you can still benefit from it. And I think that's what we see, that's what I see in so many of these installations, as I witness and have heard from folks that feeling of, it actually feels good and right to center Blackness. Mm, like there's something that feels really right about this.
It's a relief. Yeah.
It's a relief.
It's a relief. And one thing I love about the project is that you are reclaiming what a wall can be.
You know, that's certainly something that informed the initial walls. And so it's like, does something need to be different? Like, one, I think the location is so important because, again, I want this to be so easy. And then, like, I don't want Black people to have to do too much to get there, right? It should be like
where they already are. And I don't know necessarily if that means in the midst of protest, like, is that the space? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you, who is this for? Like, and who is it for first?
So it's for Black people first, but that's a real big category, mm-hmm. right?
So within that, is it Black people protesting, and in that moment, while they are protesting, is that the moment of intervention to say, come dream? What are you protesting for? Mm-hmm. Is it a symbiotic relationship to the protest that there's this other space where you specifically invite people to at a very specific time? Do you want it to be specific people within an organization or within organizing networks? Or is this very powerful when people are not planning to stumble upon this, or does that matter?
You know, I like the idea of people coming upon it and almost being like, I just love seeing those honest, authentic, fresh reactions to something they didn't expect, right?
Yeah.
And maybe it's even in being caught off guard, there is kind of an opening there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, and I'm trying to really deeply listen to you. And what I hear you say is, I love the moment of surprise and disarming, like, oh, wow, well, what is this? And like, maybe I should come in. That to me sounds more like a relationship to protesting is a relationship to dreaming. Like, it's almost like the yin and the yang, like,
right.
We're pushing, we're fighting, we're pressing, we're demonstrating, we're modeling what it looks like physically to also be free and be expressing ourselves individually and collectively. And it's almost, I could almost imagine you like tapping people on the shoulder and just like whisper, like, we need to articulate our dreams.
I think that's right. I think I want this also to be radically doable for myself in this moment, and not like overdo it and run myself into the ground as I'm doing it. And so, you know, to pull something off, I think in a couple of days. So this image I have, and it's not necessarily the ideal, but it's like what's available right now, is to, you know, have giant pieces of plywood and, you know, paint them black and write stencil or just write the instructions on the wall in some way, or print and plaster or something, you know, and to lean it up against the fence right outside my husband's restaurant, which is a Jamaican restaurant, or to do it like there's a parking lot right next to them that has this giant Jamaican flag that we painted, like the entire wall, right? True Jamaican fashion, which is just like, we are here, X marks the spot. And to either lean it up against there or the fence and just, you know, there's a line of people outside his restaurant waiting to get their food and just sort of say, do you want to dream for a second? Like, have you thought about your precious Black life today? You know, I invite you for a moment, you know, as you're waiting this 20 minutes for your food or whatever, just come share so the community knows, you know, keep your mask on. We have sanitizer for you. But you're welcome to just share what's on your mind, what's on your heart, and the things that you want. And so it's sort of, I guess what I'm getting at is like the beauty of Blackness in daily life. Like I'm getting food from a restaurant and I still have dreams for myself. I'm getting food for a restaurant and I get a chance to reflect on why my life is precious,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the mundane moments,
yes.
you know, yeah. I'm thinking that.
I love that. And
it's quiet and it's, you know, contemplative, and but it's also beautiful. And I think we still need music because we always need music. and so to me, that's like the lower stakes experiment that sort of builds the momentum toward a bigger crowd, but it's like the small first test to see if this is still viable.
I love it. And I think embodying the principles at every level that you want to see in the world also really means embodying what it is that you want to do.
I still hold this global vision and how I want this to be in every town and city and in multiple places around the cities. But for right now, it's sort of like, but this is what I can do right now with these two hands, with the family I have, with the resources and time that I have. And that's enough. Like somehow it's still enough.
And she did it. She built a wall that was 8 feet high and 24 feet wide. She painted it black with her four-year-old daughter running around her. And last Friday afternoon, with the help of her community, Alicia placed this enormous wall next to the entrance of her husband's Jamaican restaurant, Kingston 11.
I have chop.
And if you just happened to be picking up your order around 4 p.m. that day, you would have seen this massive wall, and at the top of it, stenciled in big red letters, the words, "A wall for Black people."
Thank you all for coming. It was about a year and a half ago that I received the idea to make Oakland and cities around the world sanctuaries for the expression of Black thought. And it was so clear to me that we need spaces that are our own, where we can express ourselves and express what we're thinking every single day. It doesn't have to be a holiday. It doesn't have to be in response to a lynching. It's just every day. There is no greater inclusion than centering the Black experience, and I hope you will join me in understanding what that feels like. Just to even have a space on a street corner that we protect that says, no, this is for Black people. We need to know what Black people think. We need to know about their dreams. We want to know what they love about themselves and what they dream for their communities and their families. We want to know what Black people think the world will look like if they were truly safe and free. So there's hand sanitizer and chalk. Feel free to clean your hands.
And here is what the participants had to say.
Well, I wrote, what makes me feel safe is love, because I believe love includes all. And I feel like we've been excluded for too long.
Honestly, I don't really know how to put it into just a few words, because it's very emotional for me, because that's what I've been thinking about every day. I guess not having to think about it every day, that's what will make me safe.
Beautiful. Anybody want to say, what did you write on the wall and what, why? Yeah.
I said reparations, because it's time for our country to pay us back, because we're the ones that built this country. We should be paid back for it.
It was interesting to just look at the way that she phrased the questions, though. Like to say my life is precious when so much around us right now does not make me feel precious.
So what did you end up writing?
Happy and fun. Happy and fun.
So you just drove by and saw it?
Yeah.
And what was your first reaction when you saw it?
I was excited. I was like, I've been seeing stuff all over the city, but to actually see a space where we can go and like do something, I thought that was cool.
Here's what Alicia sent me after running the experience.
It is midnight, the night of this incredible experience. So my back is very sore. My feet are aching, but I'm so full and I'm so grateful. And today, as I put my hands on this beautiful black wall that had been warmed by the sun, tears just started streaming down. I'm just reflecting upon all of it, and what is really sinking in deeply is that it matters how we gather and why we gather. It has the power and the potential to transform our relationships to each other, our relationships to ourselves. It has the potential and the power to transform how we organize society.
Okay. What do you want for your precious Black life? To be healthy in mind, body, spirit, and to know how to live unafraid. For us to bring our whole selves. I love who I want without judgment. What makes you feel safe? Black aunties. What makes you feel safe? Connection, reciprocity, to be fully seen, laughter. Other black folks at work, black women. What would the world be like if all black people were truly free? We would transform the world. A world in harmony with nature, spirit, and people. No exploitation. It would be exquisite. It would be vibrant. It would be abundant. It would be liberating. Freedom for black people is freedom for everyone. And this I love. What would the world be like if all black people were truly free? We about to see.
This is Together Apart. I'm Priya Parker.
Together Apart is produced by Jesse Baker and Eric Newsom at Magnificent Noise, in partnership with the New York Times. Our production staff includes Huote Gatana, Nora Wazwaz, and Eric Newsom, with a very special thanks to Mo Mullen, Kappa Robatisse, and Mickey Kapper. The executive producers of Together Apart are Priya Parker and Jesse Baker. And this series would not be possible without Corey Sika, Joanna Nikas, Anya Stramian, Julia Simon, Lisa Tobin, and Sam Dolnick.